past January and February, I, like perhaps many of you, found myself in hunker down mode. Hard to think about it now, with all the greenery and the warmth and the sun and everything that's surrounding us and making this such a lovely day, it's hard to remember all that snow and ice and cold, say nothing of those power outages. It all had me and perhaps many of you not wanting to be out and about any more than was absolutely necessary. So I took to writing. Got out my notes from a writing seminar I took last summer, and before I knew it, I was writing a childhood memoir, which in some places stretches into some later points in my life. Unlike my three previous writing projects, which did result in books, this one is more for me and my family. We Eddingtons are having a family gathering this summer to mark the 100th anniversary of my father's birth in 1909. And I partly had that milestone in mind as I did my writing. What struck me about that writing seminar, going back to that, was that when the leader gave us her instructions that would set up an exercise for us to do something, and then we'd all go off and write for a while. And when she did that, what struck me was how much I wrote about the summers that I spent from the age of 5 until I was 13 at a small farm my grandfather and some of my other relatives had on the outskirts of a small Ohio river town. I know I've told some of those stories from those summers here already, and there was nothing that I wrote back last summer or when I revisited my notes this past winter, nothing there that I wasn't already aware of, and in most cases, stories that I had already told in one setting or another, which is to say there was no recovery of any long repressed memories or anything like that. But even though the stories were familiar, what was different, was putting them into a single narrative and then being able to connect with how some of those events from my earliest years did foreshadow some of the things that happened to me in my later years. I hadn't quite put that piece of it together until I wrote it all down in one place. It was a very surprisingly instructive exercise for me. I suggest you might want to try it for yourself sometime, maybe when you're looking at some long, dark, cold winter nights yourself and don't want to go out and do anything. Well, I titled my little project, I even put it together, a little thing here, I titled my project Mockingbird Hill. That was the title of a hit song that both Patti Page and the singing duo of Les Paul and Mary Ford had in the summer of 1951, which was the summer I turned 6. Very unusual, there were two hit recordings in the same year, the same song by two different artists. And I was so taken by the words to Mockingbird Hill, as it would come over this old radio that we had there, that I gave that name to a hill that ran up behind my grandfather's place to a patch of woods. And since my other relatives, who also lived on this farm there, were very big on indulging me, that became the name of that hill for all time. It still is. In fact, one of the ongoing themes that I worked into this little memoir of mine is that whatever name I gave something, it seemed like, whether it was a hill or a rock or a tree or a building or a pet, whatever it was, whatever I called it, that became its name. In other words, I had the same prerogative as Adam and Eve did in the Garden of Eden, where they were able to go around naming all the aspects of creation that the Creator had come up with. And I played with that metaphor for a little bit. Of course, if one's going to write using a Garden of Eden metaphor, of course, there's going to be a fall or a collapse of paradise at some point, which I also end up writing about here. This is not entirely a feel-good piece. But lost and found, paradise lost, paradise found is not where I'm going today. But I'm going to stay with the story for just a little bit longer. It was on Memorial Day weekend was when I shifted from my home and family mode in a little town where I was living in West Virginia to Mockingbird Hill mode when I go to my grandfather's place in the summer. That happened over Memorial Day weekend. School was out by then at that time. And somewhere between my family home in West Virginia, just outside of Charleston, and Mockingbird Hill on the Ohio River, they were about 40, 50 miles apart, somewhere about halfway between those, out a long dirt road off of a paved road, in what in those parts of Appalachia is called a holler. Now, in these more refined parts of the Northeast, that's called a hollow. As in Washington Irving's The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. Where I come from, it's a holler. And a holler or a hollow is basically, it's like a little enclave, usually back out in a remote valley, somewhat apart from the rest of the world. And the holler that served as my Memorial Day transition point in the summer was called Wolf Valley. And its centerpiece, around which the life of that holler revolved, was the Wolf Valley Baptist Church. My family was one of about half a dozen or more families who lived out in that Wolf Valley holler for several generations. Prior to World War II, with mobility very, very limited, these families tended to intermarry a good deal. I want to say the intermarriage was between the families and not within the families. I don't want to go perpetuating false Appalachian stereotypes here. And I got to say, my father opened up the gene pool considerably by joining the Navy in the Second World War and traveling 3,000 miles away to get himself a British war bride. My now 83-year-old mother, who will be the reigning matriarch at this gathering this summer, bless her brave heart. Well, by the time my sisters and I came along, some of the Wolf Valley families, like ours, have moved out and scattered, while others remain there. But on the Sunday of Memorial Day weekend, for all I know, could still be going on, I don't know. But on the Sunday of Memorial Day weekend, the drill was that all of those who had or had had families in that holler and who could make it back, as most of them did, would gather at this little Baptist church for this big multi-family reunion. The images I have of those gatherings are 1950s vintage cars pulled off of a dirt road and up onto the grass around the church. Grass around the church. It was not a lawn, just grass that grew there. You pulled your cars up onto it. And endless, just endless quantities of food. Everybody brings all this food. And someone at some point would usually bring in a batch of ice cream, which would have to be eaten quickly before it melted. And invariably, a kid or two would shove down too much ice cream on top of everything else they had consumed, and would have to make a mad dash to some nearby woods when it all started coming back up again. It was just part of the scene. And then there was the preaching. Preaching, as it usually came out. If a crowd of people were gathered around a country church on a Sunday afternoon in southern West Virginia, a few preachers were bound to show up. And at some point, as if by some mysterious signal, people just went into the church and sat on these hard wooden pews, and one preacher after another would hold forth for a while, usually with some singing and amening mixed in. And every year, as a matter of an ongoing ritual, this one old guy would get up and sing Church in the Wildwood. And he sang it in such a long and slow and drawled out way, I swear it seemed like it went on for about as long as some of the sermons did, because he knew all the verses. And the summer I turned 18, and just before heading off for college, I actually joined in with some of the other preachers who would come by for the Memorial Day reunion to do a little holding forth of my own, if you can imagine that. What I had no way of knowing at the time was that I was then right on the cusp of a journey that would take me far away from that setting. Far away, that is to say, when it came to my own religious and spiritual journey. But as you can probably tell, I've never lost a certain kind of affection for that whole scene. Well, after the preaching, we'd all go back to whatever food was left before folks started packing up to leave, and I would get into the car that one of my Ohio uncles had driven over with my grandfather and other aunt, and I would go off to Mockingbird Hill, and my parents and sisters would go back to where we lived in Charleston. There was a central ritual at these gatherings, though, that I've not mentioned. A little less than a mile further up the road from the church and going up a rather steep hill was what was called the Number 3 Cemetery. I have no idea where that name came from. I don't know if there were numbers 1 and 2 cemeteries somewhere else out there or not. But this was called the Number 3 Cemetery, and you hadn't really fulfilled your reason for coming to the reunion. If you did not, at some time in that afternoon, take some flowers up to the Number 3 Cemetery, place on the graves of your family members who were laid to rest there. Not everybody went at the same time. It wasn't like there was a procession or anything. It was just whenever the Spirit moved you to go and fulfill your Memorial Day duty, and then you went to your car and you got the flowers you brought with you and you walked up to the cemetery. Some of you may remember this holiday was also called Decoration Day, in addition to Memorial Day, which meant it was a time to decorate the graves of loved ones, people who had passed on, family, friends, loved ones. A couple things stand out for me now, as I think back on all that, through the many summers I've known since then. And one is this intriguing combination of festivity and the recognition of death. You know, the food, the catching up on the news, which was mostly gossip, and the kids running around just being kids. Even the preaching and the singing, it all contributed to a very festive type of atmosphere. And no doubt provided at least a brief but still happy respite for the folks who lived out there, many of whom were living very hard, tough lives. But you also had to go to the graves. Had to see that they were properly cared for, properly decorated, pay your respects, perhaps say a prayer of some sort. What I've come to see in the ensuing years is there's something really universal about this whole phenomenon. No one, I am quite sure, at the gatherings I've described, certainly including me, for example, had ever heard of something called Dia de los Muertos, Mexican Latino celebration of the Day of the Dead, which we in some fashion observe here occasionally when All Saints Day and Halloween come together in the fall. The Day of the Dead also involves the sharing of food and drink and festivity, along with remembrances or visitations, in some cases, the graves of the deceased, in order to communicate with or feel the presence of the souls of the departed. And I've not done any real research on this subject in any kind of depth anyway, but I would imagine that examples from many cultures and across the span of human history can be found wherein this combination of festivity and death intertwine. And so as isolated and remote as they may have seemed, those Memorial Day gatherings back in that West Virginia holler were really but one expression of something much, much bigger, something that's been going on for as long as human beings have been in existence. I think this also has something to do with the reason why we have cemeteries. They're not just disposal grounds for bodies or places to inter ashes. As is the case with funerals and memorial services, cemeteries really are much more for the living than they are the dead. We, most of us anyway, I would say, need to feel some sense of connection to those who've gone on before. We need a way of getting a focus on how we remain connected to those who came before us, as well as to think about what we do for those who come after us. And of course, you don't necessarily need a cemetery. You don't need a grave marker to do all of that. But they still provide one very tangible, one very real and touchable way of connecting with the past. And also a way of thinking about the narrative you want to offer, you want to leave for later generations. This finally gets me to where I want to land on the topic of lasting legacies. You may have figured out already, this is one of those cases where the sermon I sat down to write wasn't exactly the one that showed up on the screen once I got going, but I am getting there. I'm even kind of on the back nine of this thing at this point. When I got to the end of my Mockingbird Hill piece here, I was trying to come up with a way of putting a period at the end of it. This is some of what I wrote in the concluding paragraph. Our stories, unique as they may be to us, are never ours alone. They're always part of a larger narrative. Taken as far as it could go, that narrative could be extended to the entire human story itself. And even beyond that, to the life of this grand and mysterious universe in which we all live and move and have our being. All I've managed to do here is get one piece of my personal narrative a few degrees beyond myself. Well, this is a challenge I want to offer for you on this Memorial Day weekend of 2009. These questions. What is the greater narrative that you're a part of? And more to the point, what is the narrative that you are creating with the life that you are living? How do you want that narrative to be told? Perhaps on future Memorial Days, by those who will be recalling it for reasons of their own. I know that quite often, it seems like our lives are just kind of a series of events. Really, you know, like some kind of a to-do list where you just keep checking things off. There are times, I'm sure, when we resonate quite well with Mark Twain's cryptic and rather cynical observation that life is one damn thing after another. I've had my share of those moments. But however caught up you may get in dealing with what seems like one damn thing after another, try to hold on to the awareness. Day by day, you're telling a story, you're creating a narrative that is and will be a part of the stories and a part of the narratives of many other people. Both those with whom you are sharing your life now and those who probably will never even know you. As I say, what do you want that narrative to be? Well, one way to focus on that question would be to, I'd say, cite a case in point, which I'm going to do the remainder of my time here. Cite a lasting legacy that's been very much a part, that is very much a part of the story of this congregation, as well as our national community and state. A larger story that many of you here are a part of, whether you knew a particular individual or not. This past year, we lost one of our more beloved and long-term members when Bliss Woodruff passed away. Those of you who come into our congregational family in more recent years didn't know Bliss. Tragically, the final years of his life were one overtaken by Alzheimer's to the point that Bliss lost all touch with his own story as well. And as strange and unlikely a pairing as it may seem, when I think back over this past church year to some of the more uplifting events that took place here in this sanctuary, I know there were a lot of them. Two that come to mind were, first of all, the honk play that we did here, and Bliss's memorial service. And what made that service, I know many of you are here for that, what made that service so uplifting even as we acknowledged our grief in losing him, was recalling some of the parts of the wonderful story, the wonderful narrative that was part of the life of Bliss Woodruff. And that in turn is the largest story of this congregation and this community. For along with the mix of joy and grief that were at that service were some very telling and instructive things, I think, as I thought back on it, about what it means to tell a story with one's life and leave an ongoing narrative. Just going to hit a few of them. Bliss's ashes were placed in a container. I was trying to remember. I think they said it was like a cookie jar from Bliss's family that was one of his favorite pieces. They would put it on the table over there with the chalice and the campus art. And Bliss designed that thing. And he had it built the way he knew it should be built. And the interesting thing about this is that Bliss was no fan of chalice lighting. It was some of that spiritual stuff we started doing when I began my ministry here, and he was very ambivalent about the whole thing. But still, one of his guiding principles was, if you're going to do something, then do it right. And if this is what we're going to do now, then it's going to be done with a little bit of class, a little bit of style, and with the way it fits into the overall architectural integrity of this room. And so Bliss designed that table with all of that in mind. And I considered putting a marker on there somewhere, dedicating it to Bliss's memory. The reason I say I kind of go back and forth on it is because I'm not sure how well he would have taken to having his name in proximity to a flaming chalice that he never quite warmed up to. So I'm still trying to decide. Your thoughts are welcome. But the narrative piece here is that Bliss always gave this congregation, gave this church his best. even on those occasions, which were very rare actually, when it didn't quite suit his own sensitivities. If he were still here and he still had that critical sharpness of mind that he did when I first knew him, he'd be probably showing up around here this summer when we get into doing the work that needs to be done on the roof, just to make sure it gets done right. There are many pieces of Bliss's story or narrative we would do well to consider as we think on our own. He was very devoted to his family, to Miriam, the children they raised. And it was this devotion to his family, which remained constant throughout his life, that makes all the more remarkable his courage and his personal integrity when he came out as a gay man, particularly at a time when it was considerably less safe to do so than it is now. I know it's not completely safe now, but I say that in comparison to some 40 plus years ago. And even with the setback that happened this past week on the road to marriage equality in our state, which I still think will happen, I really wish Bliss could have seen where things have gone in New Hampshire since he took what had to have been a very brave and lonely step for him so long ago. He was very much a person of principle. He was very forthright in standing for the ideals and the values that are stated quite well in our own Unitarian Universalist purposes and principles. If it was through his eye, as a greatly respected and much sought after architect in this community, that made him want to see to it that things were done right when it came to how a structure looked, it was his human and his humane values that made him want to see the right thing done when it came to living out that Unitarian Universalist principle of ours that calls for justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. Those right things are part of his legacy and part of his narrative. And Bliss loved to laugh. I don't want to come off like he was some kind of a somber guy. He was one of the most cheerful people I know. One thing I remember is he came in here one Sunday wearing a coat and tie, which was very unusual for him because he always wore these sweaters. I mean, even in the summer, he wears sweaters. One day, for whatever reason, he decided to put on a coat and tie, comes to church. And Lynn Slamitz, one of our former members who has since moved up north a ways, she walks up to him and she sizes him up and she says, "God, Bliss, who died?" And that struck him as so funny, he just about that he couldn't stop laughing for several minutes. I can't remember if he took his tie off or not at that point, but he laughed for a long time. He's a very, very joyful person. He enjoyed a laugh on himself, as well as the ones he handed out. So think then of the story you tell. Think of the narrative you're creating. Think about how it's a part of the greater narrative of all those whose lives are touched and will be touched by yours. As I say, Bliss's story is very instructive here. Love and care, those closest to him. Personal courage and integrity, being true to who he was. Standing for the highest and best of human values and principles. Striving always to do the right thing. And being a person of great joy and cheerfulness. These are truly worthy elements for the stories we strive to create with the lives we live. As I mentioned earlier in our service, this Thursday we will hear some of another story that is part of the story of this church as we celebrate and honor the life of Jean Scheer. We said goodbye to her husband, Marco, several years ago. One of the many, many privileges that have been mine over the course of my ministry here has been in knowing Marco and Jean Scheer. The Reverend Robert Zorheit wrote, "Death is what happens between where we are and where the universe is. There's a greater life, the life of the universe itself, that both precedes and continues after the lives that we're given for whatever time we have. And so on this weekend, as we memorialize the lives of others, let's be mindful of the story that we are bringing to that greater narrative that includes and enfolds us all. And let's sing together in number 86, "Blessed Spirit of My Life."